A quick note before we start. About 70% of all people who listen to the show on Apple or Spotify don't follow the podcast. If you like the show, please hit that follow button. It ensures that you don't miss an episode, and it really helps spread awareness of the conversations we're having. And if you can leave a comment or a rating, that's even better. Thank you. Okay, let's get back to the show.
I'm Andrew Kitley, and this is my podcast, The Invisible Gift, a show about turning disability into possibility. From a young age, I was told I had a disability that would make it impossible for me to achieve and flourish in life. I struggled in school and felt I was not truly understood or supported. On my long road to becoming the owner of multiple businesses, I have learned that dyslexia was not my disability, but rather my invisible gift. My dyslexia challenged me every day, but it was also what made me into an independent thinker, a creative, and gave me that hard-working mindset that has taught me to never be discouraged by failure. I realised there are many people out there just like me. So I wanted to learn more about them and dyslexia itself. I realised I needed a way to do this which was great for dyslexics, which obviously rules out writing anything down and makes total sense why a podcast is perfect. I'm excited to be sharing this journey with you as we learn more about dyslexia, the incredible people that thrive with it, and how we can all transform our greatest challenge into our invisible gift. Welcome to my podcast. Today on the podcast, I'm honoured to have the incredible poet Philip Schultz. Philip grew up in an impoverished neighbourhood in New York in the 40s. He couldn't read till he was 11, and his family struggled financially throughout his young age. What they didn't know at the time is he would go on to be one of the world's greatest poets. Despite not being able to read till so late, he would start his own writing school in 1987 and would eventually become a Pulitzer winner in 2008 for his collection Failure. In our conversation, we spoke at length about his childhood, his writing school, his poetry, and how profoundly dyslexia impacted his poetic voice. But first, though, we spoke about the upcoming election and how he first found out about his dyslexia. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
How's coronavirus going for you over there, Philip?
Well, we're avoiding it. We're 110 miles east of the city, and our kids are... One's in law school in California, and the other is undergraduate in Vermont. So they seem to be safe, and my wife and I are just laying low here.
It's nearly vote day for you, isn't it?
We voted yesterday, and the election is a week away, exactly 7 days away.
I think everyone in the world is waiting on bated breath on this.
I somehow survived the draft in Vietnam and protests in the 60s and Watergate, but never anything quite like this.
No, it's funny, isn't it?
Never had a deal with a monster.
Brilliant. Right, so thank you for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it. I feel a bit honoured to have you on the podcast, really. Reading is one of my vices. And I have read your works before, which is really, really amazing. I mean, unfortunately, because of my dyslexia, everything tends to blend into one. I regularly quote books to other people and get the wrong authors on it. So I have been told off for doing that in the past. So when did you first find out you were dyslexic?
Well, when my oldest son was diagnosed with it in second grade, I was, I believe, 58. And it, the neuropsychologist listed off all the symptoms, and I realized that, oh my God, that explains my life too. It explains my childhood too. Although until that moment, I had no idea. I couldn't even tell you what dyslexia was, I don't think.
No, it's a common trait. I'm not even sure, even though I'm doing this, I'm still not really sure what dyslexia is. It's not, it just feels like a name, really. But I suppose I now, because I've met so many amazing people doing this, it feels like when I hear dyslexia, I hear creative and just thinks about things differently. So obviously what you do is really, really creative. Have you always been a creative person?
Yes, without being conscious of it. I mean, it was my childhood was my father was born in Russia. I grew up in a very immigrant, lower class, inner city neighborhood in upstate New York, Rochester, New York. Both grandfathers came over here as tailors and steerage. You had to have something and you had to have a profession in Ellis Island to get in. So they taught one another what their own trade. So a lot of them became tailors. And the Rochester was where all the men's garments, the men's tailoring factories were because of all the water for the mills. And so the world I grew up in was quite unique. And I mean, I wouldn't change it for anything because it was full of there were some Jewish families, but predominantly not. Mostly Eastern European families there, and there was a lot of hostility and a lot of you know, it was tough. It was growing up on the mean streets, so I learned how to fight and take care of myself and survive. And so I was busy with other things, and I didn't seem to pay a lot of attention to the fact that I did poorly in school, and I ended up being held back twice, and ended up at the worst of all the schools. Didn't learn how to read. I was 11 in, I believe, the fifth grade. Many of the kids I grew up around, some of them died in Vietnam, others went to reformatory. It was a world in which dyslexia, looking back through that lens, explained a lot, but not everything. The life of the imagination for me was a more feasible, safer life, a kind of island than the one outside. So I created an imaginary inner life without knowing it.
I like to think, well, I don't like to think, I've definitely done that in my own life. A vivid imagination is probably what everyone would say about me, and I never really found an outlet for it outside of really martial arts. That was my only main outlet activities. So when you say you used to get, I'm just trying to think of your creative process here. So when you created this imaginary world you used to live in, was it really visual for you? Was it completely mental? Because for me, the alternative worlds I used to create were so visual. It felt like I was there when I was in them. Is that similar to you?
Well, that's a very good question. That's a very interesting question. Because what I neglected to point out was my first outlet for creativity was painting and drawing. I once was in a department store and I saw a book of Van Gogh's paintings. And I was so overcome and struck that I stole it. I stole the book. I mean, I didn't have any money and I wanted the book. And kids like me did things like that. I got caught, and my father had to come down and get me. He wasn't very understanding, but I would go back to that. And then I found in our local library a similar book. There was something about the passion, the visual passion in Van Gogh, the transformation, the transcendence that he was after. he had obviously someone with a tremendous amount of inner turmoil, as we know, who by painting, translating all that turmoil, all that upset, all that disturbance into a canvas, you know, whatever the measurements were, somehow allowed him to look at it. And because of that, that translation, the vibrancy of color was, the passion was just so great that I wanted to do the same thing. And I would draw pictures all the time, and I would paint. I would get, without knowing what I was doing, I studied it in school. I became a school cartoonist. So the first outlet was purely visual, and I like to think that my writing is visual, that I often write scenes where people are interacting and it's taking place somewhere in a dog park after 9/11, or in a grocery store after Sandy, the Hurricane Sandy. So it was a way of relieving the tension of that inner turmoil.
Do you still, when you write now, think, is that how you think of things? Is that how you come up with creative situations? Is that how you kind of visualize how you write things?
That's a good question. Another good question. I have to think about it. I'm not sure this lockdown that we're all surviving, the tension of this awful election, all of that has to go somewhere. It can go into terrible stomach aches and headaches.
Yeah.
Or it can go into my work. I'm finishing a book about my writing school, which in many ways comes out of my dyslexia. I didn't know that. But you know, how I taught myself to read, no one else could teach me. Tutors failed. I ended up imagining what it would be like to be normal, what it would be like to be a boy who could read. And I imagined it to the point where I was able to maintain, I was able to control the anxiety that wasn't allowing me to hear instruction, and it allowed me to eventually learn how to read. So I created a method of teaching creative writing that allows you to use another writer's, another person's persona to put between you and whatever you're trying to write about, as a way of filtering it, as a way of holding it at a distance and maintaining, sustaining some level of objectivity. So, in a sense, my dyslexia and how I learned to do anything led to my starting a private school and my own creative method. I didn't understand that until many years later.
So what age were you when you wrote your first thing that really meant something to you?
Around the age of 16, I was... I read The Moviegoer, a novel by Walker Percy, and I was struck with the first-person persona of the narrator. And I think it was so affectionate and personable and intelligent and philosophical that I could imagine doing something similar at some point. And so I think I tried to write poetry probably and fiction, or I took it more seriously than I had previously. When I was 18, I mean, I had serious thoughts of being a writer. But I, mm-hmm. when I was 18, my father became ill. He had a stroke. And he eventually died of a heart attack. And I was dealing with it by reading a lot of Hemingway. And Hemingway had a lot of father-son stories. Yeah. And my way of dealing with his illness and an eventual death, which left us penniless, and I didn't know if I could go to college or even graduate high school. I was a senior. I began to try writing with a degree of seriousness that I hadn't felt before. So if I had already had the fantasy of being a writer, and it was a competition between that and painting, I was now a writer. I was taking all that grief and all that turbulence and turning it into writing. So I began a novel.
Yeah.
I was 18, just turned 18, and I started a novel called Amen, the Redeemers. I have no idea where the name came from or whatever.
It's amazing to hear where Philip's journey as a writer and artist began. I was fascinated by how articulate...
Hi everyone, I just have a quick announcement that I'm really excited to share. We're launching the Invisible Gift Community, a platform designed to provide support and resources for neurodivergent individuals. I've always been passionate about sharing conversations around being neurodivergent, raising awareness and promoting understanding, but I want to do more. So now the Invisible Gift website will offer a range of tools and resources to help neurodivergent individuals navigate the challenges any one of us can face on a daily basis. This includes information about workplace accommodations, tips for managing sensory overload, advice on how to communicate effectively, information for how to get the most out of a neurodivergent child's education, as well as providing the building blocks for them to have a successful life and much more. But to do this, we need your input. We are looking for therapists, influencers, business leaders, HR, and brand representatives to provide their input and support. If you're one of these people that wants to support neurodivergence, or if you just believe you can really help out, send my team an email on hello@theinvisiblegift.com and you can find more information on the Invisible Gift website. With your help, we can really turn neurodiversity into possibility. Okay, back to the show.
And expressive he is. I was keen to find out more about Philip's writing school, his teaching methods, and where he draws inspiration from. We speak more about Philip's family and the impact his father had and still has on his writing. First up, though, I was keen to learn about how Philip's brain works and how he verbalizes his thoughts.
Did you struggle with verbalizing your ideas? Because obviously with dyslexia, we all struggle with, I could say, if even like when we talk now, you'll hear, I struggle to verbalize. My brain works a lot better than my mouth does. So when I try to verbalize what I want to say, it's hard enough in speech, but when you go to writing, I have so many problems with spelling, trying to put the right word down is sometimes really hard for me. Did you find that hard when you first started writing?
I think writing was the only way I could do that. I mean, writing offered a conduit to translate my feelings into thought, into ideas. So writing provided me with a way of translating all that chaos into something formidable, into something for me that would be formidable. So I think writing and art before that were the only ways I could do that. I think my attraction to both, to art, was a means of trying to understand what the hell I was feeling, what was going on.
So when you're writing something, do you find it easier to write your work in tougher situations or when you're in happier places in life? This is actually more of a question. I'm more fascinated when I speak to people about them writing some or painting. Some people prefer writing when they've got stresses in their life, same as songwriters and things like that. and others prefer to do it when they're in a happier place in your life. For you, is it a mixture of both, or do you write better when you're in tougher situations in life?
It doesn't feel like a choice. It's a mixture of both. I mean, I feel when I'm passionate about anything. You know, when I met my wife and was madly in love, I expressed it in love poems. And when I'm going through something difficult, I express it in, you know, in a grief, or I deal with strong emotion, passionate emotions, translating those into my work. It doesn't make any difference as long as it's strong enough to make me want to articulate.
Yeah, so passion is your power. I get that. Okay. So you say you're you started your own teaching structure. You taught yourself to read, and now did you say you teach people as well how to creatively write?
Well, in the beginning, I was taught in college and for 20 over 20 years academia. I started a creative writing program, graduate program at New York University. But I always had my own ideas on how to teach, and I could see either when I was a student and undergraduate or a graduate student in Iowa that most teachers taught according to how they wrote. Some liked the idea of their teaching, and many didn't, being teachers. And then when I was in a position of starting a program, I was hiring people, some of whom saw themselves as teachers, and some of them saw themselves as writers who felt an obligation to teach to make a living. So certainly in poetry, you don't make a living through poetry. But there was a pedagogical passion that I had about teaching people how to express themselves. That, like how what I had done for myself to survive, I wanted to do for others. And so I developed a method of teaching based on persona writing long before I knew what I was doing. And I did it in private workshops at home. And I so much more enjoyed that than I did teaching in an academic environment that the one class became two, and I eventually left academic teaching and started my own school.
So you're still doing that now? You're teaching your school now?
It's called the Writer's Studio. The Writer's Studio, with no apostrophe.
How many students do you have in there?
You know, I'd have to ask my wife. I don't really know. it's probably around 300. We have branches.
Wow.
We have branches in Tucson and San Francisco, a new branch in Rome. We used to have a branch in Amsterdam. I have no ambition to extend it. It's just extended itself. People would move, and teachers would move, and then ask if they could teach where they were. So that's how it's happened.
It's normally people that run businesses like that through passion that they normally do grow, because you're passionate about what you do rather than doing it to draw an income. Well, I always find that everyone I speak to, the people that do it because they want to do it is the people that ultimately succeed, right?
As someone put it to me, no self-respecting Republican would buy this school because of the profit margin. It is a passion. And, this method is what I found helped me write. So it somehow helps others too. And they stay, and they even want to teach in it. So it's taken on a life of its own.
So that's quite an expansive business. So this kind of brings me nicely on to the, the kind of next set of questions that inevitably always come with people who I meet who have dyslexia is, so with all this, there's a lot of organization that comes with it. There's a lot of procedures and systems that need to go in place to make sure things are getting out correctly and you're able to do your work. So are you the person in your school that does that, or you said, I'll have to ask my wife, or do you have a group of people around you that help you?
Yes, I have a people. I'm not very good at all of that. Even to do this podcast, there was a part of me that panicked in terms of the technology. I'm not very technological. Mm-hmm. It was a small school with a few classes and a few teachers who were my students who just went on to teach, and it made a living, and I got by, and then I got married and had children, and the expenses increased, and my wife helped build it up, and it became larger. So I don't have much to do with the technological aspect of the others do that.
Yeah, the reason why it's on this podcast, the reason why I cover this sort of thing a lot is because I always say the power I have is the people around me, and I think dyslexia kind of gives you that ability to get the right people around you to help you achieve your goals, because every single person I've spoken to in this season all have incredible passions for a subject in their life, and it's amazing how dyslexic people seem to struggle with systems. A lot of people struggle with being on time and doing all these different areas, but they have amazing teams around them that are good at all that admin based stuff and help you deliver what you want to in life. I mean, I assume for someone like yourself, you've probably always had to have a strong person or people around you as time's gone on, right?
Yes. A number of the early students stayed in one capacity or other as teachers, and it's a community, and it's a very supportive community. And the idea, I guess, I could claim, comes out of my struggle with dyslexia, struggle to be normal in some way. But in helping people express, I mean, the hardest thing in teaching, especially anything creative, is encouraging and supporting people in their struggle to translate and what they really feel about the subjects they're writing about. Basically, most don't. Most people are writing about family or relationships or whatever, and they think they feel X, and they really feel Y. Because what they feel with Y terrifies them. So they bury it, they repress it. Or they want to write about old wounds that they're guilty about or whatever. And my example in my life is that for many years I insisted on writing a novel about my father, who was a failed businessman. He failed over and over and over again and married my mother, who thought he was a big shot, owned a big parking lot in the middle of downtown Rochester, and then she could finally get away from this awful neighborhood and her crazy older brother and her mother and have her own home. And she married him, and a week before the wedding, he confessed that he had an accountant who embezzled him and took all his money, and he was penniless. And he would have to move into her house.
Wow.
Even though she always regretted it, she said she married him anyway. And the few months that it was going to take him to get back on his feet became 20 years. So
yeah.
She had to watch me grow up in the same world she grew up in. How I really felt about him was very mixed at best. And his last failure left us a bankruptcy, left us all penniless. I couldn't go to college. My mother had to move back to the same house. So the years I spent trying to write this novel, I was writing a celebratory about his great energy, how funny he was, and not going anywhere near the rage and how I really felt. And there's a dyslexic element in all of this. I couldn't dare go near it because I didn't know. It was too guilt-ridden. And finally, when I wrote poetry, it was successful. When I wrote fiction, it wasn't. Because in fiction, I was trying to write about things I didn't know. I was trying to put a lie to how I really felt. But there was something about poetry that if you connect to it, it's short and sweet and the truth comes out for me.
Yeah.
So one of the tenets I do in teaching is that I help people take a subject and look at it in a way they maybe perhaps didn't look at it before. And wonder aloud and wonder, you know, how what do they really feel about what they're trying to write about? It's a form of discovery. It's difficult. It's often painful. Not everyone can do it. But the writers who are successful are able to do that.
Yeah, it's kind of like I listened to a podcast recently about psychedelics, and they said about the psychedelics allow you to kind of almost look at the past as a different person, because when you're there in front of a situation, you experience it one way, but as you get older, you would view it differently, because at different ages in your life, you view situations in different ways. So if you were to go back as an adult and look at something as when you was a teenager, you would see it very differently and process it very differently. And I suppose if you was to look at something, a situation, even if it was something that happened yesterday, and try and look at it from different eyes, you might see it in a different way. It's quite interesting. You've got me fascinated, Philip. See, this is your talent, what you've got. You've got my mind going crazy thinking about great things. I love it.
Well, you know, this is the idea of persona writing. Oscar Wilde said, give a man a mask and he will tell you the truth. And right, going back to the Greeks with masks, you use another writer's persona, narrator, not to use their style, not to use their story, but to tell your own. And it allows you to tell the truth. And however unforgiving that truth is.
It's funny. Wouldn't life be easier if the truth was spoken more often? It's not too obvious, though. I don't mind little white lies. They're probably all right. So with your creative writing, when you teach people it, do you speak, how do you put it across? Because there's different ways of teaching. There's kinesthetic, there's written, there's audio. How do you get your classes across? If you're teaching a class, are you standing in front of a screen talking, or is it just notes? How is it?
Well, I mean, it always was in person, if that's what you mean. Now, because of the pandemic, it's all virtual. But it's the same method. I mean, you give exercises. We have a craft class in which every week we teach a different book of poetry, novels, memoirs. You use that person's persona. You turn it into an exercise. We have different levels. I teach the master class. The student takes a book that they've read, the persona from that book, to do an exercise from it. They choose the exercise they want to do. And they practice using a persona to try to express themselves, or to try to express their passion. And once they do it, it becomes something that they want to continue doing. Maybe what you're reacting to is, without any doubt, this method has came out of my dyslexia. The particular struggle I had to access real feelings and compensate for all the things I couldn't do. I mean, I couldn't learn how to read or write. So I became a writer. The irony of that, I you know, when I won a prize for my poetry, which was very nice, suddenly people were asking me, an editor asked me to write this book. I wrote a book called My Dyslexia. And I didn't know, it never would have occurred to me to write a book on my dyslexia. And I really didn't understand why she was asking me to write it. So she said, trust me. So I wrote it, a short book. It's perfect for dyslexics. And it wasn't until the reaction to it, which was fairly large, you know, it was 2 years after I wrote it and went around to LD schools talking in UK, in Liverpool, and prisons where a lot of prisoners are dyslexic. It was took me 2 years to understand why she asked me to write the book. I never got it. I never got it that it was odd that someone who couldn't learn how to read and write and who was dyslexic would win a Pulitzer Prize. It struck everyone else as odd, which it is, but it took me the longest time to figure out that it was unusual that someone who couldn't learn how to read and write would be a successful writer.
Yeah.
Because if you understand that irony, I just didn't get it. But of course, so I think the school, the need to help others express those feelings came out of my own struggle with myself. And it's very satisfying. It's satisfying in a way that my writing isn't. I'm very happy with my writing. I'm not saying it's not satisfying. But the teacher in me hasn't always been simpatico with the poet. There was a fiction writer in me that hated the poet. And the poet was a little more accommodating of the fiction writer. One wanted to have movies made out of his work and be successful. And the other one just wanted to express himself, to figure out what he was really feeling.
Which one wins?
Oh, no. The poet won hand downs. I mean, I don't write fiction. The fiction was all... My most successful book is called Failure.
A key subject of dyslexic people.
Yes.
I always say every time we have a conversation on one of my podcasts, it comes back to failure. I don't know another person that has failed so much consistently at such a young age than a dyslexic person. You always fail, but you don't, a lot of the time you don't realize it's failure. But what it does is allow you to become very adaptable when you're older, and failure isn't as scary. It's just part of the process.
Right. It's the struggle that is to overcome this image of yourself as a failure. And even though, I guess what I was saying before is that even when I didn't recognize it. I didn't understand why anyone would want me to write a book about dyslexia. I didn't get the irony.
But it's great irony.
Although Philip was confused why people would want him to write a book on dyslexia, I wasn't. His journey from being an 11-year-old that couldn't read to being one of the most important poets alive and an icon for dyslexics everywhere makes him a perfect candidate for writing a book about it. Coming up, Philip and I talk about his previously unannounced book, the inspiration behind it, and we conclude our discussion with a performance by Philip of his poem, Googling Ourselves. Let's hear what Philip has planned for the next 12 months.
So you've got, you've had an unbelievable amount of success up to this point now. It must be consistently hard to keep on bettering yourself, but that poet's going to keep on coming out. What's the plans for the next 12 months for you?
Well, I'm going to finish this book on my school and on my, it's a memoir about my writing life and all the all the writers who mentored me and helped me. And so that'll be done. That's a prose book. And then I want to get back to my poetry and write a book called The Artist and His Mother, based on an Arshil Gorky. I'm announcing it here for the first time, actually.
There you go.
Based on an Arshil Gorky great painting called The Artist and His Mother, about how his mother saved him and his sister during the Armenian death march, the genocide. And she died of starvation. And he and his sister came to America, he became a painter by taking a photograph of him as a child and his mother, and for 10 years doing it over and over and over until he got it right. And the masterpiece, it's a masterpiece. And then he became more of an abstract painter. But his fascination with trying to render that relationship is equal to, I guess, what I was doing with my father. But now I want to do it with my mother. And the idea of the artist and the mother and his mother. And that obsession with taking that visual photo and trying to understand it and pour all your feelings into it, that the role that my mother played in my life.
Sounds amazing.
I'm sorry?
I said it sounds amazing. Sorry, you're not just a good story. You're not just a good story writer. You're an amazing storyteller. So I find myself locked into it's because you talk so slowly and it's really relaxing. I get so intrigued with what you're saying. So I'm like, because I speak so fast. But when you talk, I'm like, oh, what's he going to say next? I just get gripped. So I'm sitting here, and it's my job to talk as well, but I just want to listen. It's really, it's been so enjoyable.
Thank you. You're being very generous. It's a very, and you're great at bringing, you know, I didn't plan to talk about any of this. And I'm a little surprised that I'm being so completely forthright that
Oh, thank you. That's great. That's nice to hear. I do worry. This is quite new for me as well, but I love talking to people and I love meeting people. Obviously, it's harder at the moment. I'm getting used to meeting people on screens. I mean, even meeting my family on screens and sitting there talking, it's a bizarre. I love meeting people. I'm a touchy sort of person as well, so it's really, really weird for me. But it's been amazing. I'm so extremely grateful for you coming on. It means a lot to me. And, you know, there's creative people and then there's creative people. And as I say, you know, when they told me I was going to get you on the show, it was mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. And if anyone wants to catch up with you, what was your university called again? Just make sure I'm plugging everything for you.
The non-degree program, and it's called the Writer's Studio. It's writerstudio.com, only one S in the middle. Writerstudio.com.
Brilliant. And I'm sure everyone else is very excited and to see all the other stuff you do in the future. So thank you so much for coming on. I've really appreciated it.
Good of you. Thank you. I appreciate it. Okay. This poem is called Googling Ourselves, and I believe it fits into our conversation because the wanting to know who you are, no doubt, has been influenced by my dyslexia, where you never really know, or the doubt is always so great in terms of trying to get a handle on it. It begins with a quote from Nietzsche. "You think yourself wise, proud Zarathustra. Then guess the riddle. Speak then. Who am I?" These strangers with my name, it's Googling ourselves. You know, you Google yourself and you find a lot of Philip Schultzes. "These strangers with my name, busy being kidnapped, embezzled, honored, and dying at a frightening rate. The cross-dressing exterminator convicted of rape in Kensington, Ohio, sentenced to 72 years without bail. The policeman killed stopping a burglary in Thermopolis, Wyoming. Could they have imagined the Florida painter with their name communicating with extraterrestrials through sculptures made out of railroad tracks, or being written about in a poem by another member of their redundant family for a reason none of us can explain? Sometimes I fear I'm imaginary, don't really exist. Catch myself wondering why I only seem to like myself when, say, I'm wearing a teacher's face. Because I see myself only through others' eyes? In that case, who am I really? Alone at night watching a ball game, I'm always surprised when I speak to myself in third person, wondering why this man cares so much about something he plays no part in. It's easier to wonder why Nietzsche sought his soul's sympathy, a truth he knew he despised, probably feared he wouldn't survive. To imagine him up late, seeking his ever-evolving, unidentifiable self, a past more inhabitable and less unforgiving, anxious to know why someone with his name would say, "Poets lie too much. Who among us has not adulterated his wine?" Late at night, the web is a dangerous swamp, a voyeuristic self-scrutiny and addictive impersonation. The ego testifying for and against itself, seeking evidence of triumph and complicity, sanction without malice, pretext, or God. Who is this man obsessively looking up all his persona narrators, feeling like a hodgepodge, trapped somewhere between heaven and earth, spitting against the wind? Is it because he knows he's getting closer to the end? Will soon vanish and become nothing? Is this why he's studying everyone who answers to his name? Because one may have invented time or sympathy or God and will love him even momentarily for who he is?
What an honor to have Philip on the show. In my opinion, he's an incredible role model for dyslexics everywhere, and it's really easy to understand why with the way he expresses himself. Wasn't that live performance of his poem incredible? And I have to thank him for the exclusive announcement of his book, which is also an amazing first for the Invisible Gift podcast. When I first started the podcast, I never thought we'd be sharing something like this that has such a profound impact on our world. Philip, thank you for joining us. It truly meant a lot to me, and I was inspired throughout the conversation. I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did, and I can't wait to see what Philip does in the future. Just a couple of quick notes before we go. They're important ones. First off, make sure to subscribe to The Invisible Gift wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically be notified about new episodes. One thing that's really important to me is to hear what you guys think about the podcast. I want to hear more about the challenges you're facing, what you're trying to change in your own life, work and family, and hear your inspiring stories of how you've overcome the odds to achieve the incredible. I know because so many of you are dyslexic that asking you to write something to me is not going to work. So I've worked with the production team on The Invisible Gift and we've come up with an idea. Grab your phone and record us a voice note. If you've got an iPhone, use voice memos. On Android, the options are endless. Once you're happy with your message, you can email it to me. My email address is andrew@theinvisiblegift.com. I would love to start sharing some of your audio notes and stories in future episodes. Also, and I'm really excited about this, head to theinvisiblegift.com because that way you can see the amazing artwork that has been commissioned to go along with each episode this season and also find out more about each of the guests I've had the pleasure of speaking to on the podcast. If all of this is way too much for you, I get it. I'm starting a newsletter that includes all this and more, and it will come straight to your inbox. It's so simple to sign up at theinvisiblegift.com. You've been listening to The Invisible Gift podcast, presented by me, Andrew Kitley, and produced by One Fine Play. This episode was recorded by Kazra. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Kazra is the audio and visual engineer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Special thanks to Christina, Izzy, and the Cube Studios. Thank you for listening to the Invisible Gift podcast.